For the week of August 24th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 246, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
Still in Birmingham, and you know, Michael, the reason I paused on episode 246 and kind of elongated it there is because nobody corrected me during last week. I almost said last week's episode, and it was like really last month's episode. The last episode we did, I said it was episode 244, and absolutely nobody corrected me. Not one email about it.
Shame on me.
Why is it shame on... Oh, because you should have corrected me.
Sure. We had to take a few weeks off, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Well, really, what we had to do was we had to put together a fan website which counts down the days until the Power Rangers movie.
when does that come out?
July 2016.
It's morphin' time.
Now, if I was really going to take this joke to its logical conclusion, I would have told you exactly how many days.
Oh, but you didn't figure that out. I've never watched the show. I think it's like a generation, below me or two.
I think it's about four generations below me at this point.
Well, fair enough. Shouldn't we have a countdown clock for Godzilla too? Because that's happening. 2018, I questioned whether it might. The same director, Gareth Edwards. There's going to be another monster, maybe Mothra. We don't know. But the last one cost $160 million and it grossed $500 million. To me, it felt like a close call, especially since a lot of that was in China. You only get like $10 out of China. But they decided it's worth a shot.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that countdown clock started before the first movie was released. And I don't mean the first movie in 1997 or 98. I mean the first movie this year.
So that's what we can look forward to in the future. But what can we look forward to on the show?
Well, as I learned from the Emmys last night, I'm going to tease something. You know, we did take a few weeks off. We had a little unplanned hiatus, as you may have noticed. Some of our regular listeners will have noticed that. And if you stay tuned until the end of the show, you'll learn why. But on this week's show, we'll play some catch-up with some stories we've been telling you about here on Showbiz Sandbox for a while now, over the past couple of months. Stories like Amazon versus Hachette, the NCAA, I can't even say the NCAA anymore, versus its athletes. So this is the National Collegiate Athletic Association versus all of the unpaid.
Students.
Yeah, basically. Fox's bid to buy Time Warner. I actually have a beef to pick with Mr. Murdoch, who...
Because I have a beef to pick with you. You were wrong. You promised me the merger would happen.
I'm going to proxy that and give you Mr. Murdoch's number.
Okay, keep going.
We'll also, of course, talk about the Emmy Awards, which were held last night to honor the exact same people and television shows they honored the year before. Oh my God. The Emmys are so boring, they put Michael to sleep. We'll also touch on some obituaries, like those of Robin Williams and Lauren Bacall, but we don't want to dwell on those since they did occur during our hiatus kind of a while back. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. Hey, look, you're going to laugh a little, and by a little, we mean probably not at all. You'll probably cry quite a bit. A good time will definitely be had by all. You'll want to listen to the show again and again. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie in the world, of course, we base this on information from RentTrack. We have the link in our show notes. We also pull info from Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, everywhere we find it. Information on the worldwide box office, we're your only source. And the number one movie around the world is Guardians of the Galaxy, another $38 million. It's back on top in North America. It's back on top around the world. It's just about to pass $500 million. So a great introduction for another franchise in the Marvel Universe.
And I will say, it was number one 2 weeks ago when we went on our unplanned hiatus, and it's number one again, so hey, guess what? It's like we were never gone.
That's right, and they also have the number one album in the country, because the awesome mixtape number one, the collection of songs, if you see the movie, the music plays a big part in the film, and those 70s classics are there in the film, and they're there on the soundtrack, and it's the number one soundtrack in the country, so synergy at work.
Aside, I own the domain name Infinite Mixtape.
Do you?
Yes, I do. InfiniteMixtape.com. And I was going to, start a music blog and, when I was, young and more vibrant than now. I never checked the email for that at all. Uh-huh. And I did you know, just the other day.
He got one from Marvel?
Yes. They wanted to buy the domain. It wasn't Marvel, but it was like, you know, Disney.
Oh, hilarious.
And I can only imagine.
Said, sure, for $100,000.
I was like, oh, but only I had seen that before Guardians of the Galaxy was released. Well, they I could have been a millionaire.
They weren't going to pay you that much. But anyway, that's hilarious. At number two around the world, Scarlett Johansson in her action film Lucy from director Luc Besson, $37 million. So it opened in a lot of new territories. It's past the $200 million mark. It's at $216 million worldwide. And they kept the budget low on this one. I think it only cost about $40 million. So this is well in the black. Another successful franchise. I'm sure we haven't seen the last of Lucy.
Although,
so
you know, Luc Besson says he doesn't know.
Oh, well, I do.
Okay.
At number three around the world, a relaunch of a franchise. God almighty, God forbid we see an original film. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I've never seen any of them. I haven't looked at the cards. I haven't looked at the movies. I haven't looked at the TV show. I've never watched it.
Well,
but it
one is named, first of all, they all have shells. Okay. So that's
yes,
number one.
Donatello, Michelangelo.
They're all artists. Amazing right. artists.
Right. And fighting crime, I assume.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen some of their work in museums, in fact.
So they grossed $32 million around the world. They're at $240 million and counting. That was an expensive film, but it's doing well. What did it cost? It cost about $125 million. That's one report. So it needs to make about $300 million, and it's going to get there easily. So we're going to see more Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Ugh. At number four, The Expendables 3. This is going to have to do a lot better overseas to justify an Expendables 4. It grossed $23 million over the weekend. It's at $65 million worldwide. I assume it has a lot of territories to go, so it may well end up in the black and be okay. But this franchise is getting a little old and tired, certainly for North America.
You know, I forget, did we talk about the piracy issue with this particular
film?
Oh,
there's no piracy issue. Oh, the box office is down because somebody stole a copy and posted. Every movie is posted online.
No, but my question is, did we talk about it?
I don't think so.
Okay, yeah. I actually wrote a piece, if you go to celluloidjunkie.com, I wrote a piece on how that kind of, those leaks, you know, where it's posted, a pristine copy is posted before the film is released, not after,
mm-hmm.
And how the media should... It was a suggestion for how the media might want to cover that in the future, which is
with a grain of salt.
No, with not necessarily about whether it will have economic impact, rather reporting on the leak itself, whether they should do so before or after.
Oh, you're saying they should? Well, but it's news. You can't decide because you can't ignore a news story because people might then go look for it. You know. It's not their job to protect the business. If a break happens, if a crime happens, if news happens, you report it. You can't say, well, maybe it'll be better if I don't tell anyone, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that if you read the – I was talking specifically about one particular news article which ran on I can't even remember now. I think it was
– Is this the Quentin Tarantino argument?
No,
they're sending people to the crime, you know, like he said, they're posting the, you know, people are going to know about it the more you cover it.
Yes. And it was on The Verge, actually, this article, which basically talked about, you know, I downloaded it and I watched it. And you know what? It's so good. I'm going to go see it in movie theaters. And I thought, you know what? This is clickbait. You did this specifically to get more traffic, which is fine. That's your job. But you're also doing it at the expense of another commercial entity. And if somebody were to take your traffic,
there's nothing to stop them from reading about it and then going and taking it down. Keeping it secret doesn't mean that people aren't stealing it. It just means that the company doesn't know. I remember Roger Friedman, our friend who's been on the show before. He has 411.com. Doesn't he have that still?
Showbiz 411.
Showbiz 411. He was on the Fox News website, and I think he's off it now because of this incident. He reported on a pirated copy of Wolverine. And it was pirated before the movie came out. But before he even posted about it, this is the joke, remember? He went to them and said, hey, there's a pirated copy online. You know,
yes.
He told them about it and they ignored him. He's like, well, you know, he told them, he gave them a chance. They could have taken it down. They could have taken it. And they did nothing. And they reported and said, hey, this pirated copy is out there in the world. There's been a lot of bad buzz about the movie. It actually, I've watched it. It looks good. But, you know, he said, hey, it's out there. You know, he's reporting it as a fact. But he even went to them first and said, look, here it is. Make sure you wanted you to know. So, I mean, this journalist story is not to decide, you know, who's going to get hurt. You know, your job is to report the news, you know. And if you let them know, then they can take it down.
But I guess I look at it and the way the Hollywood Reporter and Variety reported on it was to say, hey, they're going after these guys. It was more news than it was.
As opposed to making an excuse for a review?
Yes, correct. Or an editorial or an excuse for a fancy headline that's going to get a lot of clicks.
When did that happen, that coverage, that review? How many days before?
July 28th.
And when was the movie out?
August 15th, I believe. So,
it was before the all media screening or anything like that.
Correct. Yes.
So no even industry reviews were up yet, I imagine.
No, not at all.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Then you might want to say, you know, they should know that the journalistic tradition is at least wait until the all media screening. That's the understanding. Even whether you get it legally or not, you're supposed to wait until then. So you might argue that as well. Hey, at the very least, they should know. You shouldn't be, you know, you want to be first. You're never going to get another screening again, hopefully.
Yes, correct.
Interesting point. Well, that movie needs to do a lot better worldwide in order to justify a sequel. That's what happened for How to Train Your Dragon 2. It did pretty poorly in North America, despite very good reviews, but it's done well worldwide. It's now past the original. It's at $575 million and counting. Thank you, China, yet again. And there may very well be a How to Train Your Dragon 3.
Yeah, except it will be only in Chinese.
It'll be Wuxia, How to Train Your Dragon.
Exactly.
At number six is If I Stay, Another Teen Weepy, based on a young adult novel. That opened in North America only. It grossed $16 million, but that's just fine because it probably cost about $11.
Yes.
That's what they're saying, so that baby's in the black. You gross your budget on opening weekend, you're going to be all right. At number seven is The Four, Three. Which sounds so confusing. The movie is The Four. That's the franchise. There was The Four, and then there was the sequel, The Four, Two. And now where's The Four, Three? It's crazy. I'm assuming there will be a 4-4, but I don't know. It's a Hong Kong action film. It's a wuxia film, actually, isn't it? I think it is, actually.
Yes.
It is. Where is my notes? It's the third in a trilogy that began with The Four and The Four, Two. It's a period wuxia tale. It's a fantasy adventure tale about crime fighters who work for the government. And it began as a series of novels, and they've been a TV series, and I imagine a manga at some point, and now these live-action feature films. And in every incarnation, the name of The Four remain the same. Emotionless, Iron Hands, Life Snatcher, and Cold Blood.
You know what? You should actually get a job as a voiceover specialist.
Oh, as a voiceover.
Can you say Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark?
I cannot as well as you. I got to cut down on the cheese if I do that. That opened in China and Hong Kong. Does that count as two territories? I forget.
I believe it does, yes.
Still, despite the integration?
Yes, because I believe they have different release dates.
Okay, so it grossed $15 million over the weekend, and nice strong start for the third in that trilogy. And number eight is Into the Storm, a B-movie disaster environmental pick. That grossed another $12 million. That's at $68 million worldwide. So I think that's just going to be fine, isn't it? That didn't cost much. Oh, it cost $50 million.
So I was going to say, you used the word disaster very appropriately with that film.
Well, not yet, because it didn't do great in North America, but it's got a lot of room to go overseas. We'll have to wait. If it grosses $150 million, they'll all be happy.
That's true.
And number nine is Let's Be Cops. That's a cheap film. That's at about $50 million worldwide after a couple weeks. And that's just a dumb buddy cop movie, right?
Yes, and it only costs like $20 million to make. So
right, even less than that. So it's doubled its budget already. So that's doing just fine. And then at number 10 is Frank Miller's Sin City. What is it called? It's Sin City 2. I forget what the subtitle is.
I think it's A Dame to Kill For.
A Dame to Kill For. This is the flop. This is the disaster of the last few weeks.
Yes.
The original Sin City seemed fresh. I was never that big a fan of it, but it seemed fresh. It was kind of cool looking. It was sort of pre-300 with a neat graphic novel look. They adapted the graphic novel of Frank Miller like frame by frame. I mean, they really captured the look. They just did what was there on the page and brought it to life. And people loved it. It did really well based on its budget. It got good reviews. Fans loved it. It did great on DVD and Blu-ray. It was just a big success. And then nothing. They waited years to put out the sequel, God knows why, and now it's not a good movie. The technique seems dated. Everybody's bored by it. They've seen it in other movies, done better. And so a big shrug of indifference for this film. It grossed $11 million on its opening weekend. Not a good start at all for what is probably a potential franchise that they have trashed.
Yes.
I mean, there are lots of these books in the Sin City series. They could have made 5-6 movies, so they really blew that one. And number 11 is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Still chugging along. That's at $556 million worldwide. Good success story. And number 12 is When the Game Stands Tall, another inspirational sports film that's here in North America. It grossed $9 million on its opening weekend, below expectations, below what people were expecting, but it only costs $15 million, so they'll be fine. And I think there's one more movie to talk about. Oh, a couple movies. Let's jump down to The 100-Foot Journey. This is the Helen Mirren film. It's produced by Spielberg and the Weinstein brothers. I don't know why they're all involved. They must have had a novel they all liked, or I don't know how everyone got entangled in this project.
Well, sometimes it's because one person options it and they don't want to, they're not going to make it, but somebody else wants to make it. So they say, okay, well, I'll sell it to you. You know, you can make it, but then I'm a producer. You know, it's this weird, it's the way that Harvey Weinstein is a producer on the Lord of the Rings franchise.
Right. They had optioned it at one point and right. didn't get it off the ground, but they still had were entangled in the rights.
Exactly.
So this is a cooking film. Is it set in India? I shouldn't say that. I don't know where it's set. I know there's elements of other cultures. I'm not sure where it's shot or done, but it's a film that my mom wants to see and will enjoy. It's doing very well. It's grossed $40 million, most of that in North America, where it has grossed $32 million to date. So there's a lot of the world to go. It's a big success for Helen Mirren. It only cost $22 million to make. So she's proven herself a box office draw well into her career. So that's nice to see. And down at number 15 is The Pirates. This is another South Korean film. It's an epic adventure tale. It's a period piece. Apparently, the royal stamp has been stolen and swallowed up by a gray whale. And now the pirates and the bandits are both competing with each other to capture the gray whale and retrieve the royal stamp, which I assume will be invaluable. So it's an action film, it's an adventure film, it's a period piece. It's opened in South Korea. It's grossed $40 million so far. It looks like fun. If these movies can cross over to the rest of the world, I know they're very popular in Asia, but if we can get English language people to start seeing these very popular, very commercial films that they're making, they're really going to break big.
Well, you know what I think is going to happen is that there are probably some executives here in Hollywood that are looking at these films and trying to figure out through algorithms and numbers and crunching all of their...
Why do people like them?
Yeah, why do people like them? Should we remake them? Should we, you know, just, you know, take them and throw subtitles on them and release them here? They're trying to figure out, will these be successful in Western cultures?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's we've seen popular international films open in North America, like, you know, obviously... Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and lots of other movies. Certainly remakes, films that are remade all the time from here to there and from there to here. So that, you know, TV shows, movies, books, television, it happens constantly. So I'm sure that's happening. But for me, the big question is crossing over and making them more popular the way, say, dismissive Chop Saki movies. You know, the Bruce Lee films sort of had cult followings in North America. These should be wide appeal, big, broad mainstream movies.
Well, and more to the point, what I probably should have said is, no matter what numbers they crunch, no matter what algorithms they have, they're
make a good movie.
Yeah, well, their predictions will be way off.
That's right, because we were looking at what were some of the movies. I think If I Stayed did okay, but what was Sin City was way off in its tracking. I think If I Stay was a little off. Some were way down, some were way up, and we've had this problem for months, if not a couple of years now. Tracking just seems to be a joke, especially for movies with a strong core audience. Like, they always underreport what a black themed film, and by that I mean a film starring black stars that black audiences are going to turn out for, that everybody should enjoy. But those movies have that core audience, and they always seem to underestimate how strongly they will open. Same thing for fanboy films, or same thing for films with, you know, bad buzz. They overestimate how well they're going to do. Tracking seems to be no better than, you know, Bones and a witch doctor.
Tea leaves.
Yeah, why not use tea leaves? And somebody, there's a great quote. I think this was in the Hollywood Reporter.
No, it was in Variety, actually.
Oh, Variety. One top exec said, research is expensive and it's wildly inaccurate.
Yes.
To which I say, well, why are you paying for it? What's the point of tracking? I know they say, well, we want to get a sense because then we know and we can adjust the blah, blah, blah. They're just scared and they just want to have early warning indicator about how a movie is doing. But to me, it seems pointless.
Well, they also need some CYA, which in English stands for cover your, well, there's
yeah,
a name.
Behind?
Yeah, pretty much.
Say ass. I think you can say
ass. I think so. We won't get bleeped, especially since I'm the one with the bleep button. But that said, they basically...
But I mean, how does that cover your ass? It doesn't.
Because they can go to, you know, the powers that be and say, look, you know, in the past, with tracking, we've done A, B, and C. Here's how this movie tracked. We did A, B, and C. So we didn't do an extra ad buy. We didn't do some extra billboards. We did too many billboards. you know what? At the end of the day, they have some numbers to back themselves up. But everybody feels safety numbers.
The tracking is no good.
Well, I think that now
maybe a tracking person industry should call us and say, "What do you mean it's not good? 90% of the time, we're accurate."
I like what Paul DeGarabedian said, and he is now with RentTrak. Of course, he was with Exhibitor Relations, then he was with Hollywood.com, and he's been doing, you know, box office stuff for like 15, 20 years, it seems like. Anytime you see a quote, it's usually Paul DeGarabedian, which is kind of funny since he has a name that is very difficult to pronounce and most people butcher. Well, he said, like astrology, tracking is hugely entertaining, and sometimes it's right, and sometimes it's not. I like the way he compared it to astrology.
That's nice. And of course, astrology is never right.
Yeah, well,
it may be vague enough that you pretend it links to your life, but it's not right because it's total BS. But anyway.
Now, speaking of being right, I know that you've slotted this story into our notes here in this particular moment in time. You know, I don't know why it's here. It could be in Big Deal, Big Whoop.
We don't have an I was wrong section.
Oh, okay. Well, that's because I'm never wrong. But a couple weeks ago, I said that, and this is your beef to pick with me, which I will then kind of defer to Mr. Murdoch, Mr. Rupert Murdoch, for those of you who are unaware who Mr. Murdoch is, that 21st Century Fox, which used to be known as 20th Century Fox, owned by News Corp, they made this $80 billion acquisition offer to Time Warner. And I thought, well, you know, that certainly scared away any other potential suitors for Time Warner. And Time Warner said, no, we don't want to be bought. We don't want to be bought, which a lot of people felt was negotiating. That was a nice way to negotiate. Not $81 billion, but $90 billion. And Fox was putting themselves in position to purchase this, you know, to do this acquisition. And I said, well, it has to happen now. Look at what Murdoch has done. He has been told in the past, no, you can't buy something. And that hasn't worked. Look at the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones. He was told, absolutely not. You're never going to own this. Here, sign on the dotted line, and it's yours. So he has been—he has always overcome these obstacles. So I thought a couple of things. One, if it doesn't happen with Fox, it will happen. Somebody will buy Time Warner because they now know how much it's worth, and it is worth more than the stock. So somebody will have to—so shareholders will kind of force this issue. However, I don't think shareholders really felt that they wanted to be acquired. And those are shareholders of Time Warner. Time Warner put themselves in a position to make it a little bit more difficult for shareholders to push the issue. And 21st
century regulators were going to fight it every step of the way.
Exactly.
If they did their job.
Don't get me started on that. 21st Century Fox also had a little hiccup there. And News Corp had a little hiccup, which is that their stock price took a huge hit, which meant that to do a stock and cash deal, it started to become a little bit more impossible for Rupert Murdoch. So it wasn't just people saying, no, you can't do this. It was, no, you can't do this. And oh, by the way, your wallet says you can't do this,
mm-hmm.
which is a little bit more important to Murdoch than anybody telling him no.
So what are the ramifications? We know that CNN is sort of in play in a weird way. We realize more and more how valuable HBO is. That's part of Time Warner, but it seems to be the lion's share of their profits. That one channel.
Yes.
Is a huge part of Time Warner. HBO alone is just a monster.
Yes, that is true. And as was pointed out during the Emmys last night, it was formerly the channel in which you could watch Poltergeist again and again and again.
Well, all right. So it's fallen apart. And can we look for anything in the future to happen because of it? Not another merger, but I mean, what's going to happen? Anything?
Well, I think if anything, if the shareholders of Time Warner are patient, which they should be, the company will be worth far more than the $80 billion offered by 21st Century Fox in a few years, if not sooner than that. That said, I think 21st Century Fox certainly did some damage, if only by making an $80 billion acquisition offer. They know that nobody, well, what they did was they put a price tag on it that others will have to meet, thus mm-hmm. making it impossible for others to bid on it. Unless they have $80 billion, they can scrounge together to purchase Time Warner. So if anything, they kind of did this preemptive offer.
Preemptive setting of the price offer?
Yes, correct. In other words, you're right. And Michael, you did mention that CNN is now in play. HBO is now in play. If you wanted to dismantle Time Warner, sure, start selling off parts of it. But the reality is, I don't think Time Warner wants to do that because it would be worth far less without those entities and those properties. I don't think
Really, they've already spun off the print division, Time Inc.
Yes, although have you noticed more and more, the Tribune did that with all of their newspapers. They basically wall these publications off like a cancer. And they say, no, your profits and revenue is declining. We don't want that to affect our stock price. So we're going to put a very difficult business that probably needs some buttressing in a completely separate bucket. And we're going to take all the profitable bits of the company and put them in a bucket of stock that can rise. It's really not the way to go. As look at Kodak. You know, Kodak mm-hmm. spun off Eastman Chemicals, okay, which is now a $9 billion company. And if you look at – and they did that in 1994. And if you look at Eastman Kodak, well, guess what? They filed for bankruptcy. I think they're worth like, you know, maybe $1 billion if they're lucky.
Mm. Well, one major corporation that's doing well is Disney. They, of course, have Guardians of the Galaxy, yet another successful franchise launched from the Marvel Universe. They had a record third quarter in earnings, and they've got a lot more Marvel and Star Wars movies coming in the next few years to come. So, and Pixar, of course. So Star Wars, Pixar, Marvel, and of course Disney. So they've just got everything in the world going right for them, and their stock exploded. Time Warner stock went up as well, didn't it? Their earnings went up. And I think after the failed bid, I think their stock went up as well.
Yes, well, because they fended off the failed bid, which means that they are probably worth more than the $80 billion offered, which is precisely, I mean, I don't want to say it's what Murdoch was after. I'm sure he would have liked to have won the bid and acquired Time Warner. But really, it was successful. Murdoch's bid was successful in kind of making it, putting it out of reach of several other companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are the Emmys worth? That's what I want to know.
Not much. Not much, as a matter of fact.
Well, the New York Times said they're worth more. It used to be just a prestige element, but their argument is that now, with so many channels and so many shows, that the value of an Emmy is greater than it's been in a long time. We know back in the 80s and in earlier eras like that, an Emmy win could save a show. It helped propel Hill Street Blues, it saved them from cancellation, along with The Cosby Show. It brought Gagney and Lacey back from the dead. Cagney and Lacey.
Yeah.
It brought them back from the dead, literally, since they were canceled, I think, twice during their run. So the Emmys can be very powerful, keep a show alive, keep a show going. And they think it's more valuable than ever. And yet, there was the show. What was going on? The Emmys were boring. A lot of the same winners. What the heck? I didn't watch it. You watched Seth Meyers. He bores the living daylights out of me. What did you think?
I thought Seth Meyers was, he was kind of flat. He came out, he did a lot of inside jokes. First of all, if I was his agent, I would actually take him out to dinner and say, what did I do to you? You had like 900 jokes about agents and how bad we are.
And that's so tiresome, and it also doesn't play to the TV audience.
No, not at all.
It's like one does, a clever one. You like to feel insidery, but like 10 jokes about your agent? I mean, come on.
Yeah, and then there was that inside joke between McConaughey and Woody Harrelson about the plagiarism in True Detectives.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's pretty inside baseball too.
Yeah, and they said it and then immediately kind of went, wow, that kind of didn't work. So was that too inside?
Well, the show did fine in the overnights, though. Why talk about overnights since people will probably start watching it in the next few days and that'll add a couple million viewers, but about 14 million people watched per the overnights. And last year was a record year for the last 8 years. So that was a freak year because of football overruns. 18 million people watched it last year. But in the last 8 years, this is the best rated show except for that one. So it's the second highest rated show in 8 years for the Emmys. So moving it from Sunday to Monday just to avoid football did not hurt the ratings. So that's a good sign. People still care. And yet, what did they watch? They watched Modern Family win for the fifth year in a row. The first sitcom to win 5 Emmys ever, much less in a row, since Frasier. That's the only other show to do it. I think they both did it in a row. And I think everybody agreed that Frasier was the best sitcom. It's one of the best of all time. It kind of deserved that, though I found it a little tiresome. But in the case of Modern Family, I don't think even the people making the show think they should have won it 5 years in a row.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like Jim Parsons. I think even he won for Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
And I think even he is saying, you know what? This is getting embarrassing. It's like the applause is going on too long. Settle down now.
Right. So Sherlock won out of the blue. It's the third or fourth season, and suddenly they've embraced that show because they think Benedict Cumberbatch is cool now. Martin Freeman won for Sherlock, right?
He wasn't even there to accept the award.
Right. Well, that happens. But he was nominated for Best Actor for Fargo, which we thought he would win, but he didn't win for that. He won for something. It's just like nothing seemed to make any sense. Breaking Bad won, of course, Best Drama. And it felt like old hat, even though, hey, it's one of the best shows of all time. It deserved to win. But the problem there is the Emmy calendar.
That's right. I mean, I agree with you and what you're about to say. So I apologize for interrupting. Go ahead. You're right.
You interrupting me? You know, they used to have the Emmys right before the new season. And that meant you'd had a summer of reruns. You were getting geared up for the fall. And now you could celebrate the previous year of television. All the shows began in the fall, maybe some in the spring, like January or February. And you run reruns in the summer. And then come the new fall season, you begin with the Emmys. And then here come the new fall shows. But nowadays, shows run 24 hours a day, 7 days a year on 500 channels. A new show can debut in July. It can debut in March. It can debut in August. You know, there's no rhyme or reason to it. And so now the Emmy calendar is a nightmare because last year you had Breaking Bad season finale, series finale right before the Emmys.
Yes.
Right? So they're celebrating the show. It felt like the right moment. The show was, you know, a huge success. It ended well. We won the best drama. Now, a year later, it's been over for a year, and it's celebrating it again. And it feels tiresome. But what are they going to do? You know, Under the Dome debuts in the summer. Other shows debut in the spring. Others in the fall. There's no place you can place the Emmys that would make it timely and relevant. There's always going to be shows now that are off loop, that feel like they're old news. You know, you can fix that, I think, with music. You can take care of it with the Tonys. But with the Emmys, I think it's just a problem that they can't overcome. They're going to always seem weirdly out of sync now because shows debut 365 days a year.
Well, first off, look at the Tony Awards. They won. Now, this is the Tony Awards that Neil Patrick Harris hosted back in 2013. There has been another Tony Awards that has occurred and another Tony telecast that has occurred since then. And
that's the rare show that, you know, debuts in the summer, and, you know, there's nothing they can do about it. You have to actually watch the show. You have to have a cutoff of some point for the Emmys, and they have it in like May, I think, in order to get ready for the Emmys in August. So, you know, there's nothing they can do about that. That's the one award show that takes place in the middle of the summer.
Yes. Well, and I, you know, it just kind of speaks to the calendaring issue. You know, there was another issue that was joked about up front by Seth Meyers, and a lot of people then brought up again, which is this whole categorization of what show goes where. And you had, you know, comedies in the drama category, dramas in the comedy category. You had miniseries that were in the series category, series that were in the miniseries category. And what I loved was Kathy Bates. She wins this award for miniseries for, what was it, American Horror Story, right? She gets on stage and she's surprised. And then she goes on to talk about the show's different seasons. She said, oh, last season was great. This season's going to be even better. And I thought to myself, great, then give back the award and have them repick because you just won Best Supporting Actress for a miniseries.
Well, I think if you're talking about the boring choices and you had a sixth Emmy for Allison Janney, a sixth Emmy for Louis C.K., well-deserved, a fifth Emmy for Julia Louis-Dreyfus, a fourth Emmy for Jim Parsons, a fifth Emmy for Modern Family as a best comedy. When you see all these repeat runs, there's a couple things going on. I think one big one is pushback. Pushback against stuff like that, shows that are in wrong categories. I think voters are sort of resisting that and saying, you know what? I like you, but you don't belong there. You're not a miniseries, or you're not a TV movie, or you're not a comedy, and I don't want to vote for you for that category. So I think some of it might be that.
Well, and I'm, you know, in talking to different colleagues and acquaintances in the industry, I'm trying to figure out whether it's pushback or whether it's audience size. But look at Netflix, nominated for 31 awards last night. 1-0. So right. My question then becomes, is it pushback against streaming and Netflix and this alternative way of producing and making content, or is it just that the audience size isn't large enough, so therefore you look at these big network shows like Big Bang Theory or like Modern Family, and they have just such a large audience, millions and millions of people, that of course all the Emmy voters have seen it?
Well, I think it's like the old school days of the Oscars. There are more voters at the major networks. You know, there aren't that many voters at FX. There are a lot of voters at CBS. And yeah, those are the shows they watch too. I mean, it should be about the best of television, but of course, it's also the shows you watch. They watch Allison Janney and Mom, God knows why. I mean, she classes up that show, but it's not a very good show. It's genius compared to 2 and a Half Men, and she's a very good actress, but good Lord. You know, there were four other people who deserved it more. Jim Parsons for Best Comedy. Any of the other actors would have been more interesting picks. Any one of them. And yet, you know, he won it because 20 million people watch it every week. And there's a lot of people at CBS. So you, I bet you're seeing a lot of block voting, whether intentionally or not. And that used to happen in the old days. You worked at MGM, you voted for MGM Films. You worked at Warner Brothers, you voted for Warner Brothers Films. You're going to get in trouble. I'll tell you this, though. It's not a popularity contest, because if it was, Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead should be in the mix, and they're not winning anything. They win, you know, technical awards sometimes. But these are some of the most popular shows on TV. People are watching Game of Thrones. People are watching The Walking Dead, but they have an animus against fantasy and horror and sci-fi. They don't think it counts as serious television, which is ridiculous. Same thing for Buffy and a bunch of great shows in the past. And yet they get ignored year after year. So it's not pure popularity, because if that was the case, Game of Thrones would win and Mad Men would not, because that show has about 2 to 3 million viewers a week.
Yes, that's true. And True Detective, I mean, look at how much a part of the cultural, I think when we talked before the show, you used the word cultural zeitgeist. That show is, you know, talked about by everyone, and yet it wins nothing.
Well, it happens, but they have very good ratings too, right? That's a very successfully launched HBO show. That's not a critic's darling. That's, you know, got 10 million people a week watching it, doesn't it?
Yes, okay. So maybe that's a bad example. Well, you know, it just goes to show you, though, if you're on cable, and by the way, you look at that best male lead in a drama series, or you had Matthew McConaughey, you had, was it Woody Harrelson was also in that, I think? I can't even remember, but just looking at that, it was chock-a-block with huge names, Bryan Cranston, and you know, one after the other. And I just thought, wow, any one of those guys could win. And I think even Julie Roberts said, I am so glad I'm not in this category. And I thought, wow, it really is a good time to be working in television. And Stephen Colbert, okay, so he won last night for Best Variety Show. Just goes to show you're on cable, it doesn't matter how many people you watch, you're still not being watched the way you are on a big broadcast network, which is why he's going to a broadcast network when David Letterman retires and taking over The Late Show. Gwen Stefani read the name of the show. Did you hear what she said?
No.
She said, and the winner, the Emmy goes to the Colbert Report. And I was like,
apparently she's not a fan.
I was like, so A, you don't watch the show. It just was like, wow, okay. So how did she mess that up? And he even then kind of said something about that.
So we've got a lot of block voting because there are more people at networks. So there are more people voting who work at CBS and NBC and ABC. We've got a lot of lockstep voting, I guess. They vote for the same people year after year. We've got people voting for the shows they actually watch as opposed to shows that are critically acclaimed, because you can be critically acclaimed and have a million viewers, and you can be banal and have 10 million viewers on a major network. But
wait a second. To your point. I don't know what. Well, you know what? I should let you make your point first, since I just interrupted you.
But I never do.
But you use the word banal, okay? Mm-hmm.
Or banal.
Whatever that word is, it kind of means ambivalent, right? I mean, kind of like, eh.
No, it means banal. It means bland. Boring.
Okay. Yeah. So to that end, okay, Jay Leno comes out last night, and I wish you'd watched, okay, that response that you just gave, I wish you'd really watched the show, because he comes out to give out, at the end there, to give out the award for best comedy series.
Jay Leno.
Jay Leno.
All right.
Now, I don't know whether he was a last minute ad or not. It did seem that way.
Big star. He's an NBC emeritus, you know.
Yes. However, unlike all of the other awards, the presenter read the names of the nominees, and the announcer did the names of the nominees for that particular category. And I thought, well, that's odd. How come he didn't do that? He came out very tepid applause. He came out, the band was playing Route 66. Okay, so they're already.
Because he loves cars.
Yes, and they're already kind of dating him to that song.
He loves cars.
He then did this tired joke of, hey, it's hard to believe we're only a tenth of the way through the evening.
That's classic Jay Leno.
And I was just like, really?
That's why Middle America loves him.
And that's why he's no longer on the air.
Oh, and I disagreed with that, and I was wrong. But anyway, you're looking at all these patterns and all these reasons for the dull voting. And the one thing is clear, the Emmys are broken, because there are a lot of interesting shows in the world, and yet the same people win year after year. It takes them a long time to recognize new shows, and when they do, their time is usually past. You know, they've got a very broken system, because a lot of people talk about a lot of television right now, like Orange is the New Black, and shows on cable, and shows on over-the-top streaming systems, and this and that and the other thing. And what's happening What's happening at the Emmys? You're falling asleep.
That's true. And well, think about it. The Oscars, the Emmys, they were all designed to
promote, pat themselves on the back.
Well, and to promote the shows and or the movies or movie going, and to help build awareness of either a property or an art form. Well, that's not really happening anymore with either the Oscars or, well, maybe with the Oscars, but certainly not the Emmys.
And look at all the changes. I mean, there's an interesting thing this week. Poirot, who's, did they mention Poirot, Hercule Poirot on the air? I imagine not.
You know what? Maybe they did. I know they mentioned Doctor Who.
Well, they should, because the new Doctor Who just debuted over the weekend. I haven't even seen it yet, which is crazy, but because I'm in Birmingham, Alabama, and a doctor, apparently, the TARDIS can't make it here. But Poirot, it's a very hard name to say, by the way, Hercule Poirot. He's been on PBS for a long time. This character has been on. They've made every novel, every story, every scrap of paper that Agatha Christie wrote about Hercule Poirot has been turned into a TV movie or episode portrayed by David Suchet, and they finally reached the finale after decades of him playing this role. It's a beloved television institution, and the final three episodes, final three TV movies, they had three that aired on PBS. There are three left, including Curtains. I forget what they call it on the air, but that's the name of the novel that Agatha Christie wrote and put in a drawer in which it was Hercule Poirot's last case. It's called Curtains, and those final three episodes are airing not on PBS, where it's been for decades, but on acorntv.com. acorntv.com, which my mom subscribes to and loves, said, we want them for ourselves. We're going to keep the finale of a decade-long project. It's been going on since the 80s, I think.
Yes.
You know, forever they've been doing these shows, and they're going to take these incredibly valuable things and put them online only. You know, they'll come out on DVD and Blu-ray eventually, but PBS doesn't get them, because that's the power of building a library and bringing people to your cable channel or your website in this case. You know, it's just amazing. But that's the changing face of television. It appears anywhere.
Well, you know, speaking of changing faces and systems that might be broken, while we were on our little hiatus, I guess some authors were a little upset at Amazon. 900 writers, in fact. They you know, there's been this whole Amazon versus Hachette thing going on for a while. And Hachette
And Amazon's so annoyed because they're like, we're the underdog. Why does everybody think we're the big bad bully? And yet everybody thinks they're the big bad bully.
Well, they're trying to lower the price of ebooks. And
No, that's not accurate.
Okay, well, explain what's going on then. Because that's not a challenge.
They're trying to keep everybody else out of the business by underselling ebooks at a loss. They drive everybody else out of business, like, you know, Borders and eventually Barnes and Noble, and then they'll have the whole property to themselves. Well, they're not trying to look out for the little guy. They're looking out for themselves.
Well, okay, that's where I was headed with that. That's where I was going to head that statement to. They claim they want to lower the price of ebooks. That's probably a better way of saying that. But I agree with you. Really, what they're doing is they're saying, hey, guess what? Barnes & Noble can't sell it for $9.99. So there. The publishers and the authors are saying, great, you're selling something for $9.99. That means less for all of us. Amazon's argument is, look, you know, and now they're finally talking about this. Before, they wouldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. However, the authors all teamed up and they took out an ad in Authors United. They bought an ad in the New York Times, a full page ad, and so
might have been a 2-page spread. I forget. Well, it was big, whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, it had everybody. It had Michael
Stephen
Lewis,
King, and, John Christian, you name it, everybody.
And so Amazon immediately reserved the domain name Readers United, and they kind of explained their case, which is, hey, you know what? Here's the deal: if we price something at $9.99 and you sell 100,000. If you're talking about a book that's going to sell...
They say you'll sell more copies at a lower price and everybody makes more money.
Exactly. That's their point.
And they want to determine the price, not the people who actually create the product and trying to sell it.
That's right. The store wants to create the price, not the manufacturer, which never works out too well.
Well, I mean, that's what... You can't do that, right? That's what has to happen legally. The manufacturer can't tell you what you have to sell it for.
Well, it's a manufacturer...
That's why it's called a suggested retail price.
That's right.
But, anyway, the fact is Amazon created the ebook market nobody else had. They created the first e-reader that people actually wanted. They turned it into a big business. It's where the future of books should be for a lot of people, for a lot of books. They did have to pull the publishers kicking and screaming into a reasonable price point. There's no reason why a book should cost the same as an ebook format than it should as a print edition. That's ridiculous. It should be lower. But... You know, there's a happy medium, and they're punishing authors as they try to negotiate with publishers. They're putting them in the middle between themselves and publishers, thinking that the authors would turn on their publisher and saying, why are you doing this to me? And instead, they've turned on Amazon.
Yes.
They said, hey, we're on your site. We promote books. We do interviews. We do talk. We have our ebooks there. We thought we were partners. You're so mean. And Amazon has got a bloody nose, and they're feeling very embarrassed and annoyed.
I found one thing in this New York Times article very interesting, and it was an article about Douglas Preston, the writer, who was in his little hamlet there in Maine and kind of heading up this 900-writer group. He took his own numbers. Hachette sent him his own numbers. And this is from the article. He said about half his book sales used to come from Amazon, but since the retailer started discouraging orders of Hachette books, his paperback sales are down 61% and his ebook sales are down 62%. His last novel, which was written with Mr. Child, I guess,
Lee Child.
And it was published by Hachette in November, was White Fire. A week before publication, 25,000 Amazon customers had pre-ordered a copy. And their new novel, which apparently they get to write a novel every month. I mean, you know, most authors would be happy to have a novel every year. They have several a year. His new novel, The Lost Island, came out, I guess, in early August or late July. It had only a few thousand pre-orders, all made before Amazon lowered, you know, the boom, as the New York Times puts it, on Hachette and stopped selling forthcoming Hachette books. And he and his wife, Preston and his wife, were saying, wow, that is, I mean,
they're really hurting them.
Yeah, the financial impact is staggering, at least on the author's side.
And that scares the authors because they see Amazon as the last man standing, and they're scared about that. They don't want them to be the only game in town because they saw what happened to the record industry.
There are
no more record chains. They saw what happened to DVDs and Blu-rays. People don't stock them anymore. Walmart and Best Buy and all these electronic stores stocked Blu-ray and DVDs, undersold the competition, sold them for less than they cost, brought in customers, and those stores that actually carried DVDs and cared about them went out of business, like Tower Records. And then Walmart and Best Buy and other people, they moved on to something else, and now they barely stock DVDs and Blu-rays anymore. You know, the shelf space has shrunk to almost nothing. CDs, almost nothing. And so people in books are scared that Amazon will be the only bookstore left. And a place that they originally loved, they're now scared about. And you can't be the underdog when you're the 900-pound gorilla. And that's what Amazon has to learn.
And you know, Apple did learn that with the music industry.
How so?
Well, I mean...
What should Amazon learn from Apple?
Well, that they basically created this, they kind of upended
digital market.
And they upended the music industry. And then when they wanted to negotiate with the music industry to do a streaming network or a streaming offering, it was very difficult. And television and movie studios, they were very careful in negotiating with Apple because they were the 900-pound gorilla, even though they continued to say, no, we're still the underdog. Remember Microsoft? And they said, yeah, but you kind of killed the music business. So, now you're talking about movies and television shows. We're not really going to create the same problem that the music industry had.
Right. And Amazon has done a lot of good. They created this market. They are right. Ebooks should be cheaper. Publishers were too scared of them. That's all true. But people are aware that, you know, lower prices is not always better if it means in 5 years you're not going to have any other bookstores left.
That's true.
Suddenly, you know, if you have $9 books for a while, even if the prices don't go up, it's not nice to have just one person selling books. That's a scary proposition.
I agree. Well, I think it's a bit of a look. The whole thing is I think an important it'll be an important case, and it'll be historically important. It has yet to resolve itself.
It's a big deal.
Oh, okay then. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or, you know, just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, hey, it's about Amazon.
Love ya.
Some people pay to play video games, but Amazon is paying, that's right, $1 billion to watch people play video games. That's right, to watch people play video games. Yes, Twitch, the popular site for sharing videos of video game footage, sold to Amazon for more than $1 billion. Why is that? Eyeballs. 55 million people a month watch videos of gamers in action on Twitch, and Amazon wants them. We've also seen video game competitions fill major venues where fans can watch them live. Video games they're a big business. We've talked about them here on Showbiz Sandbox before, and now so are the people who watch them. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big deal.
Huge deal. Yeah.
You wouldn't think video games could come of age, but frankly, they are as a sport, if that makes sense, or an entertainment event. And I can remember, like, I don't know how long, when did Twitch start? A year ago, 2 years ago?
I think it started out as Justin TV, and they changed, they pivoted, as they say in business.
Ooh, I got to learn how to pivot.
Yeah. Basketball helps, FYI.
Yeah. When did they pivot?
I think they pivoted about a year or two ago.
Because I remember being at my mailbox and the guys who work there who always see every Marvel movie in 3D IMAX, even though I try to talk them out of it and this and that. And suddenly they're referencing Twitch. And they're like, oh, yeah, man, I was on Twitch watching the video. I'm like, watching a video game? But I'm quiet and I shut up and I go home and I look it up so I don't look stupid.
And it's this huge business. Now, what is also a big deal here is that for the last 2 months, it's been rumored that Google has been negotiating with Twitch. And they offered $1 billion. So I guess Amazon came by and said, well, we'll give you $1.1 billion.
And they said, sold.
Yeah. And Google said, yeah, we're not upping our offer.
This is like life is online. There was a story, I think it was in Variety, and we have a link for it, about YouTube stars. They were ranking stars and people and how well known they were. And for young people, for teens, people who are stars on YouTube that most people over 25 have never heard of, they are more popular to teens than big movie and music stars. Those people are the same. You know, they see some big person who's got a comedy channel on YouTube or a music channel or whatever it might be, a skit channel, and they just see them as just like, you know, Will Smith and Eminem and Miley Cyrus and all these other people. They're just part of the mix of their life. And so, you know, the online is a big, big deal.
In fact, if you look up PewDiePie, okay,
he's exactly. He was number one, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's huge. And I, you know, I've been following him now for about a year.
What, are you a stalker?
No, just, you know,
following online.
Yes, yes. And, you know, do you know this musical act, St. Paul and the Broken Bones?
I do very well because I'm here in Birmingham and I know people who love them. And just like Alabama Shakes, they've got a very good old school vibe and they're breaking big.
Yes. Well, I think that part of the reason they're breaking big is because they have videos on YouTube. And
doesn't everybody?
And what I love to do is I play the music and I play the video for people and I don't let them see it. And then I say, okay, you hear the music, you hear the voice, and then I turn the laptop or the computer on, I let them watch the video, they're just shocked at who is singing this song. There's like a disconnect, and I think without that visual footage, that visual kind of connection...
You mean it's a white boy singing or what?
Well, it's forget about that it's a white boy. It's a guy that was a bank teller last year at this time and looks like he couldn't, you know...
It's like the Hold Steady effect. They don't look like rock stars either.
Exactly. And then you see him and you're just like, wait, that guy? That voice is coming out of that guy? And I think that effect is helping because people are then sharing, going, look, you got to watch this video because it just makes no sense.
All right. And if you watch a video, you're going to do it where? On your TV, on your laptop, on your phone? It could be anywhere. You get your videos anywhere. You get your TV anywhere, which takes us to the next story.
That's right. Plenty of people would love to subscribe to HBO without buying a huge cable package. And that's me included, by the way, Time Warner Cable. Better watch out. It's called Over the Top, by the way, that kind of subscription service, making a service like a TV channel available online via an app without demanding you also be a subscriber to the channel via a cable or satellite provider. So Over the Top, OTT. Well, HBO is absolutely expanding on its OTT plans.
Finally!
Yes, yes. Here's the problem, Michael. You just have to move to Sweden. Now, they've been talking about this for, you know, they've been doing it in Denmark and Norway. They've been doing this already. So they're expanding. That's right. With subscribers in the U.S. holding steady at about 29 million, with only a net total of 400,000 added to its total over the past 6 years, overseas is really another matter, with HBO adding 10 million subscribers in 60 countries. They also license programming in countries where they don't have a channel, and overall, the amount they charge is not a premium like in the U.S., so they've experimented in some Nordic countries going over the top and are now ready to offer that option in more and more countries, presumably the ones where they don't have their own dedicated channel. Worldwide, HBO and Cinemax have 108 million subscribers. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop.
What?
Well, because they're only doing it in the places where they don't have a cable channel. And they don't have, so it's not going to affect us. It's not going to affect anyone. They're still not changing their philosophy. They're saying when we can't do what we normally do, we'll go over the top. But if we can do it the way we like to do it, which is to have a channel, a monthly subscription, and the way we know how things work, we're going to stick to that. So they haven't really changed. They're saying, all right, we're going to fill in the nooks and crannies with over the top, but we are not changing our philosophy about no over the top in the countries where we have established channels.
Yes.
And why? Because they get about half of the $16 fee many people pay for the channel. So they get $8 a month for all those 29 million people. That's 30 million people times eight. That's $240 million a month. They account for $1.8 billion in operating profit for Time Warner. They are one fourth of its entire total.
Wow.
My God, Time Warner's profits, 25% of it come from HBO. No wonder Fox wanted to buy it. They're not buying Time Warner. They're buying HBO and getting some other crap along with it.
Well, they should start their own premium cable channel then.
So, and their HBO is also worried about limits on broadband, both technical and nefarious. So, I mean, you know, nefarious would mean that cable providers, meaning Time Warner Cable again, would step in and say, hey, we need to charge more. And technical would mean we got problems with Netflix. Oh, allegedly. You know, you've got a lot of traffic, though, when you've got Netflix online. That's to be fair. And they may put in the technical stuff to make that easier. But imagine if HBO, Showtime, CNN, and CBS were online over the top along with Netflix. That's a lot of demand, isn't it? I know they could all put in place the technical stuff to make that easier. Does that mean we could do it technically, Sperling? Is it not an issue? Or would the demand on bandwidth be really extraordinary and actually do what cable providers pretend is happening with Netflix, which is slowing things down?
Well, it absolutely could. More traffic means, you know, you need bigger infrastructure. But in my opinion, right now, the infrastructure is in place in most areas. Mm-hmm. Certainly in some rural areas or some outlying areas, it may not be. But in areas like around, you know, large markets, it should be okay. But I will say that during the evening with Netflix, it can definitely get jammed up. And that's all those interconnects.
But that's only if it gets jammed up because they don't allow everybody to do what could be done to make it work smoothly.
Yeah, it's more like, you know, when the mob comes and, you know, says to storefront owners, gee, it would be really a shame if something bad happened to you. You should pay us some protection from, you know, us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, there are traffic jams when you come home from work, and there would presumably be traffic jams if all the major channels were over the top.
Right. But there's a lot of dark fiber out there. The question is, how quickly will that dark fiber be used up, and how far does that dark fiber go? Does it go all the way to the home, or does it just go between backbone providers?
And will that dark fiber make me more regular?
Wow. Okay. And
but speaking of over the top, Dish is planning to go over the top by the end of the year. Dish is the satellite service. And they have got a bundle of channels, and they want to go over the top. They want to offer that as an option, not as an add-on for the subscribers, but as an entirely separate service. So you don't need to have a satellite dish. You don't need to have cable. You just buy their over-the-top service, and if you have internet, there you go. You've got channels like Disney and A&E. Those are on board. Obviously, they've got to have a good clutch of all the major networks and some of the big channels for it to work. We'll see what they have when they go public.
Well, yeah, you know, what's interesting about this, Dish was the first group they negotiated with Disney, and they got the right to sell their networks, the Disney-owned networks, without a cable subscription. So mm-hmm. over the top. They were the
and
first.
That includes ABC?
They were one of the first groups. I don't know. I don't want to speak. I will say this, Vubiquity, which is one of these backbone providers.
I beg your pardon.
Yes. Well, what used to be called Avail TVN. That was the Avail network and the TVN network, they merged, and now it's called Vubiquity. They're the ones that provide the back end and the infrastructure for all of these VOD, SVOD, so video on demand and pay-per-view type services. The folks that I speak to regularly over at Vubiquity, they say that up until recently, everybody was talking about linear cable and linear offerings, meaning what we all have today, offered, you know, one channel after the other.
Streaming a channel and at 8 o'clock is this and 9 o'clock is that.
Right. Now everybody is negotiating and talking about, you know, basically SVOD or VOD.
The world on demand.
Yes. Nobody's talking about linear anymore.
When they talk about SVOD, do they mean that
Netflix is SVOD? Subscription.
Right. So
video
once
on
it's
demand.
Available, it's available. So if God help us, the Big Bang Theory, it's whenever it becomes available, it's just available. It's not that you just wait till Monday at 9 and then after that it's available. It's just there has to be released, obviously.
Yes.
And there would be, I guess, a time, but it would be more about just on demand than a particular time when it's first ready.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, Michael Egan, you may remember him as the accuser of director Bryan Singer and several other Hollywood figures, has filed a motion to dismiss his lawsuit against Singer without prejudice. And what that means is that he could refile the case again later. He is also trying to block his attorney from leaving the case. A couple problems here. Singer has already filed a motion to dismiss the case with prejudice, and Egan's attorney has already moved to disconnect himself from the case. He's trying to distance himself.
Disconnect sounds like Scientology, but yes. Anyway.
I saw that word there, and I was like, well, I'm going to say he's going to distance himself from the case. It will all be handled in court one way or another, along with the malicious lawsuit charges filed against Michael Egan and his lawyer by Garth Ancier, formerly of Disney TV. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop because it's just the latest small step in this case, and it's not over yet. That happened on August 5th, and I can't find anything since then. So it seems to have slowed down. It's ugly. It's sad. Who knows what will happen?
Tom Petty won't back down. Do you get it? Because those were...
You could have sung it.
Oh, that's true. Why didn't I think of that? Well, after charting in five different decades, he's finally scored his first number one album with his band's new release, Hypnotic Eye. Making it even sweeter, he did it with old-fashioned rock and roll, dethroning the disposable teen pop of the boy band 5 Seconds of Summer. Wow, I've never even heard of that band, so they really must have only been popular for 5 seconds this past summer.
I see, you look so perfect standing there in your American apparel, in my American Apparel underwear.
Oh,
you know that
that's
line,
them.
Right?
Yes.
That's them.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, sure, you'd still rather see them in their American Apparel underwear, you know, that those 5 seconds of summer. But you'd rather hear a new song by the guy who wrote American Girl. Petty's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but he's not done yet. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. God bless him. His first album came out in 1976. That's 40 years ago, practically. 38 years ago. That's unbelievable. I can't believe he never had a number one album before. I mean, Damn the Torpedoes went to number two. That was in 79. And now it's all the way to Hypnotic Eye. You know, he had solo albums like Full Moon Fever. That went to number three. He had stuff with the Wilburys. Did they go to number one? I don't know. But it's a super group with him and Bob Dylan and
Roy Orbison.
Lynn and Roy Orbison. So, you know, who knows? But how awesome that he finally did it after all these years. And, you know, a well-reviewed good album. It's not just the fact that albums are selling so little. You know, it generally did well. So good on him. And no, the Traveling Wilburys didn't go to number one either.
Okay.
His absolute first number one album.
Okay, well, you have to sell a lot fewer albums these days to be number one, so maybe that helped.
That's true, but you can still sell a lot of albums, because like Adele, for example, her album has now officially sold 10 million copies in North America. Adele's album, 21, has become, this is crazy, the 21st album to sell 10 million copies in the SoundScan era. That began in 1991 when they started to track actual sales rather than reported sales. So they were actual sales figures at the register, and it has sold 10 million copies officially. And boom, she's there. She's one of 21 people. There were like 8 women, I think just 3 or 4 men, and all the rest were groups. And I'm counting among those 8 women, Celine Dion, solo album, and Titanic, which also sold 10 million copies. You know, she was a monster there for a while. And so that's a big, big blockbuster. And her new album, 25, comes out any day now.
Well, you know, speaking of Celine Dion, and this is a bit of an aside, I was surprised at the news that she's taking a break due to health reasons.
Oh, really? I didn't see that.
Yeah, it got very little play.
Oh, well, I hope she'll be okay. What was it? I mean,
they didn't say.
Well, you know, we also had reported on Neil Young, and I was always correcting people because they talked about his Kickstarter campaign for his Pono. They talked about it as if it was a fundraising service to launch his business, and it wasn't. The Kickstarter campaign was really just a chance to be the first on your block to buy a Pono player. You know, you pay $200, you get it at a discount, and you get it early, and maybe it's signed, autographed by Springsteen or Neil Young or Pearl Jam or whatever. And so the Kickstarter campaign was hugely successful. A lot of people wanted to buy a Pono player, you know, well before it came out, and they raised $6 million. And now he's doing an actual fundraising for his new business. He's gone to Crowdfunder. They want to raise $2.5 million. And so far they've raised $1.5 million. So I shouldn't say that because I haven't checked it out lately, and it's probably higher by now.
Well, you know, you have to be somewhat careful there because of the way you fund things. The SEC has some control over that. You know, you can't, because these people will be investors, correct? They're not just buying the thing.
I believe Crowdfunder is actually investment. Yeah, it's not Kickstarter where you're just giving the money, and if they want to, they can give you some tchotchkes, but you have no rights or obligations or anything like that. It's just, hey, good luck. Here's $20. And if you send me a CD later on, aren't we all going to be happy?
Well, I guess Crowdfunder has a way of doing that legally.
I'm sure
with
they
the
do.
SEC.
It's a,
yeah.
It's a legitimate business. Yeah. And just like we have those Broadway campaigns now where you get to fund a Broadway show.
Right.
That we talked about a couple weeks ago.
That's right. Well, now, we've also been talking about the Metropolitan Opera.
Maybe we should be doing crowdfunding for the opera.
Yeah, that's true. Well, actually, that's not so far-fetched, although you probably would never see a return.
Well, they do already. No, you wouldn't make any money, but they do it already. It's called fundraisers.
Yeah, well, you know, as we said, the Met has been walking a difficult tightrope. Audiences are dwindling and graying. Artists are used to serious coin for their specialized and highly praised skills. Backstage hands see everyone else pulling in big bucks and naturally want the same. And something somewhere has to give. And you know what? Maybe it has, since reports say the Met has reached tentative deals with two of its biggest unions, the musicians and the singers. If these deals can serve as a template or templates for the other unions, it's possible they'll avoid a crippling strike and delay in the new season, set to start in about a month. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's great that they've gotten moved forward on this. My only caution is that the deals they made were with the two unions, musicians and artists, that are sort of aligned with each other and with the front office, as opposed to the blue-collar unions that work backstage. So I think those unions have been sort of at odds with each other. Now, there's a lot of animosity between the singers and the backstage people and the musicians and the backstage crew. There's no love lost. So it doesn't follow that because they made a deal with the artists on the one side, as they would call themselves, that they're going to be ready to make a deal or follow that template with the blue-collar people. And I mean that as a positive thing, but the guys who are lifting things and lugging things and putting up the sets and building stuff, those are very different people and they don't get along. So it doesn't follow that one is going to lead to the other the way it does in Hollywood, where you have directors and screenwriters and actors and all those other people sort of following suit.
You know, not to stay on this story, but it's almost as if nobody has seen The Phantom of the Opera. You know, you don't pick fights with the people who hang chandeliers over your head. You know what I mean? The late night wars have a long way to go, but clearly David Letterman was right to announce his retirement. If he'd had to do it after his recent tumble in the ratings, it would feel a lot sadder. Instead, he got slightly ahead of the curve and looks like the classy one. Meanwhile, Jimmy Kimmel on ABC leapfrogged ahead of Letterman in key demos like 18 to 49 for the July sweeps. Fallon, on the other hand, spiked 39% from Leno's ratings in that demo from last year, and beat Kimmel and Letterman combined. So, Michael, do you feel silly for thinking NBC was crazy to dump Leno and ABC crazy to switch the strong Nightline for, you know, the weak Kimmel? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, and I was wrong. I was definitely wrong. I'm glad Letterman is going out with his dignity intact. He definitely picked the right time. It's a clear changing of the guard. You know, Jimmy Fallon's done great in every possible way. Jimmy Kimmel's done great. Nightline has done well. I was absolutely wrong. I was too conservative, too old school, too clinging to the way things were in the past. But I'll tell you, I look at the late night lineup of Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel and Seth Meyers and Craig Ferguson is disappearing, and it puts me to sleep. Oh my God, they're all so boring and awful, but that's just me. I was with my nephew yesterday at a restaurant, and we referenced Johnny Carson. He asked if celebrities went to the U.S. Open, and I mentioned, at Wimbledon, you know, Johnny Carson used to always go, and he said, who? And I went, oh my God. I said, this is the guy before Jay Leno. He's like, I mean, Jay Leno was his entire life.
Did you ask the waiter to then bring the wheelchair that's at the front door for you?
Exactly. I said, it's not your fault for not knowing who he is, but it makes us feel old. And he looked at a photo and said, oh, I recognize that guy now. And I said, yeah, well, don't worry. Someday you'll mention Jon Stewart and some guy will go, who? And you'll say, oh my God.
Yes, that's true. Well, our next story, as The Hollywood Reporter concisely put it, a court ruling may have a major impact on the multi-billion-dollar business that is college athletics. We've been talking about this. Student-athletes alleged antitrust and restraint of trade over the fact that, you know, they're forced to sign waivers, keeping them from sharing in the revenue, the multi-billion-dollar revenue, by the way, from TV rights to college football, along with video games and other sources of money. The judge saw no reason athletes couldn't benefit or share in a trust after they graduate and waved off the school's claims that the current rules encourage competitiveness or protect student athletes.
Protect them from making money.
Yes, that's right. certainly don't protect them from concussions. We've all learned that. At the same time, the NCAA made these huge rules changes that give more leeway and more power to the biggest conferences like the SEC. In other words, major changes to the NCAA, college sports, are afoot. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
The rule changes that they made alone mean it's the end of pretending that all schools are equal. They're not, and it's never going to happen again. And it's an end, thanks to the court, to the lie that these are student athletes. They're not. They're athletes who are probably, their career won't go past college for 95, 98% of them. And the few that do get through to the majors, almost none of them will go pro and make it onto a field. And almost none of them will have a career beyond 5 years and actually make money. So it ends that ridiculous charade that we have of pretending that these guys who were generating lots of money, you know, shouldn't share in the profits when they have a skill and it's not going to take them much farther than college. You know, so thank goodness for that. We'll have to see what happens. But I do feel like there's going to be a sea change. And in 20 years, I don't think football is going to be popular anymore the way it is today. I think too many people are telling their kids, you're not playing football as kids. You know, you're going to let your kid play football. The more and more athletes who step forward and show the debilitating illnesses that they have, how is it going to be fun for people to watch football? I don't like watching boxing anymore. I mean, that's still very popular, but it's nowhere near the cultural presence that it was in days gone by, back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
I actually have heard an argument that said, look, you know, boxing, it's man versus man. We can see their faces. It's one person against another, and it's personalized because of that. You're tying it to a person, the damage done.
It is personalized, yeah, but football, when more and more star athletes come forward, just a guy came forward yesterday, and you hear their stories and see how debilitating they are despite paddings and cushions and helmets and all the wussy stuff that the old school people hated in the first place, I don't think, how are you going to enjoy watching the game?
I don't know.
And kids aren't going to play it. Their parents are going to say, you know what? Play lacrosse, play soccer, play something else.
The sport called baseball. It used to be a pastime.
It'll take a long time for football to fade away, but I wouldn't be surprised if we've seen the beginnings of it.
Maybe CBS has a UK quota to fill. That might explain why they've been looking for far and wide and for someone to replace late night talk show host Craig Ferguson, he of Scottish fame. So he's from the UK. Their pick? Apparently, it's British actor James Corden, a 35-year-old who's become a big star in the UK but is virtually unknown here in the US. Still, he's got one chance streaming on Yahoo for free for 10 days.
That was 3 weeks ago we talked about
that. Yeah, the Weinsteins put that up there. After being part of the ensemble in the acclaimed theatrical smash hit The History Boys, Corden has gone on to oversee and star in a UK sitcom, win a Tony for the comedy One Man, Two Governors. I can never pronounce that right. One man, two governors. And now has films like Into the Woods and a potential Broadway turn in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. Does CBS care? No, not really. They're more excited that he understands social media and has more than 4 million Twitter followers. That's what they're really interested in.
It's true.
With him and Stephen Colbert on CBS, they're hoping to throw a wrench in the complacent worlds of the two Jimmys. And those are Fallon and Kimmel over on NBC and ABC, you know, those guys, big deal or big whoop.
It's a big shock. How the hell did they come up with James Corden of all people? I mean, how did they come up with Craig? I mean, Craig Ferguson was on a US sitcom for many years. He was sort of a known quantity. How did they come up with James Corden? I like him a lot. I don't know why he'd do it. He's got everything in the world going for him. Theater, he's done well on TV. He's got a role in a big movie coming out. I'm not sure why he'd want to stop all of that to make a TV show, because you can't do anything else.
No.
Right? I mean, that's it.
It's a daily grind.
It consumes your life. I don't know why he'd want to do it, but he seems to be the guy they want. They're clearly in serious negotiations. I'm shocked and surprised, but I'm intrigued. And frankly, if Stephen Colbert and James Corden, two more white guys, can shake things up with all the other white guys, I'm happy to see it happen. But I've got a bone to pick with Craig Ferguson.
So do I. I've got a huge bone to pick with him. But
go
ahead.
Do it. You first.
Well, you know, don't say, look, this was all my doing.
Yeah.
I want to retire from doing a talk show.
I know you don't believe me.
You probably think I was fired, okay? And that I would do this talk show for the next 20 years if I could. But no, you know what? I'm tired of the daily grind. I don't want to do it anymore. So I'm leaving, the end of the year. What I will be doing instead is a talk show.
Right. He's announced he's going to take a talk show, a half-hour show, into syndication in early hour prime time, meaning like 7:30, say going into the prime time channel. What? That is completely bizarre. First of all, he lied to us. He does want to keep doing a talk show. It's going to be the same shtick. It's going to have his goofy personality. I mean, I'm sure it'll be geared more towards early evening, but it's a talk show. And it's a half-hour talk show in syndication before the primetime show. It's crazy. It's so weird. I mean, I love them. I hope it works. I'm glad I get to see them some more. But it's nutty. It's a nutty, weird thing to do. And it's nutty to do it in the time slot they're doing it. Certainly, he doesn't want to be in late night.
No, you know? that's a train wreck.
So it's the only area where there isn't a talk show. You got talk shows in the morning and the afternoon. You got talk shows late at night. I guess talk show early evening, right before prime time. That's the only, you know, territory left to conquer. So it's going to be weird, but I'm going to watch it and see what happens. But yeah, I do feel a little annoyed that, like, Craig Ferguson assured us with his sincerity that, you know, this was, no, his desire wanted to move on to something new, like a talk show.
Well, I think also this is more of a show like The View, where it's going to have more than just him.
No, I thought that's what I read. No, I don't believe so. I don't think so. But there you go. Well, I mean, it seems like a weird idea and a bad idea is Ricky Gervais recreating David Brent, the character from The Office. He's doing a movie where David Brent goes on the road and he's going to be trying to become a rock star like he was doing in one of the last specials that they had for The Office way back in the days of the UK show. And so they've made a mockumentary film following him on the road as things fall apart. You know, he's still a salesman and he cashes in every chit he can to pay some union guys, you know, some regular musicians, actual musicians to go on tour with him. And it's all a big disaster. And there's a film crew making it. And he thinks they're making Stop Making Sense. And in fact, they're just making sort of a Where Are They Now spit for about this guy who used to be on this, you know, reality show, which is the backstory for David Brent. So he's recreating his best role. It seems like a bad idea to me. You know, God bless him. I hope it works out and it's good. But, you know, why go to that well anymore?
Ricky Gervais was very funny on the Emmys last night.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, at one point, they pointed to Ricky Gervais. I think it was Jimmy Kimmel said, you know, I can't remember who it was, you know, Matthew McConaughey, a big movie star, look at his face. And he doesn't, you know, that's not a TV face. Ricky Gervais has a TV face. And he immediately kind of made this face. And I thought, wow, that was really like, he like was right on it. Quick witted.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, now speaking of bringing characters back from the dead, the Vampire Lestat lives again.
No!
And for those of you not old enough to know who the Vampire Lestat is, well, I guess you're not vampires. Or we should say the Vampire Lestat is dead again, I suppose. Since vampires are dead, you know they're not alive?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, anyway, the famed Anne Rice novels are set for a reboot. If the Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt flick Interview with the Vampire can be considered a franchise film. I guess you need more than one, though, right? Rice has written about 13 novels in Lestat's world, with a new one out this fall called Prince Lestat. I guess he's, what, Lestat got like a promotion? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Now Universal and Brian Grazer's Imagine Shingle are looking to start from scratch and turn it into the monster hit franchise the novels always deserved to be. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. They're a big property. They've been around for a while. That original movie was, you know, marginally successful commercially, but never quite matched what it should with all the other, you know, successful properties out there. Why wouldn't they adapt the Lestat novels and try again?
Yeah, well, you know, I think they may have missed the vampire curve here.
Well, it's just the good movie curve. That's all you need. Just need a good movie.
Okay. Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, Michael, I was going to put this up front. Motown is leaving Broadway. The musical, you know, Motown?
I do. So let's...
But they're not leaving Broadway.
They'll be back.
But they didn't say, I'll be back, like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Didn't.
So we've got a little Motown news. It's kind of intriguing. It might be a model for the future, but let's cover up some other entertainment news in the theater world and see where they're at and finish up with Motown, because that's kind of the cool, unusual thing here. But we have Emma Stone, star of the Spider-Man movies, a very good actress. I took my mom to see Magic in the Moonlight together, and there was Emma Stone with Colin Firth. Not a very memorable film, but she had a good time. But she is going to be on Broadway in Cabaret. She signed on. She was originally recruited to do the role. For some reason, it didn't work out schedule-wise. Michelle Williams did it. It wasn't a triumph, but she did well. And, you know, she got some polite reviews and friendly reviews, and she did it. By God, she'd never been in a musical before. Well, now Emma Stone is going to do it. And frankly, going second in this case is kind of a plus. You know, if Michelle Williams had killed it, you would hate to follow her. Just like whoever poor schmuck has to follow Neil Patrick Harris. In this case, you know, she can't lose. Either she'll do just as well as Michelle Williams or she'll do better. And everyone will say, oh, she's even better.
Right.
Right. So, you know, that's good to see. But we got a lot of box office news. Cinderella is still hanging on. They keep announcing new cast members, even though you look at the grosses and you think this show should have closed ages ago. Aladdin, that is the Disney musical that has really come into its own. It is a big, big hit. It's established itself as a name brand. Motown has slid a bit, and Aladdin has really taken its place towards the top of the list, right up there with Wicked and The Lion King, which are still, of course, going very, very strong. Kinky Boots is fading a bit. That's the show that won Best Musical over Matilda, but Matilda is now edging back up there. It's selling out. It's doing very well. It's really established itself as a family show, and I think Matilda will outlast Kinky Boots and have the last laugh. On the other hand, A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder is the other show that won the Tony. Kinky Boots won it 2 years ago. A Gentleman's Guide won it this year, and they are now selling out almost a year after the show opened to really soft box office. And that makes it a classic example of a show boosted by winning the Tony for Best Musical. There's no better example right now. And then If Then is another big musical that's really struggling, just like Cinderella. Idina Menzel is in the show. The only reason to see the show is Idina Menzel. The second she leaves, the show is going to close. So I think she certainly feels an obligation to stay there every week. Right now, it's like making about $600,000 a week. It might even be losing money week to week. So I don't know what they're going to do. It should be closing any day now. And we've had two shows who've sort of been linked from the day they opened. They opened a couple weeks apart. There was Newsies, a classic old-fashioned Broadway musical, big dancing and choreography and fun, and Once, which was a very modern and clever and subtle and quiet take on the musical. I absolutely loved Once. I thought Newsies was fun, but I thought Once was just genius. And they've both been on Broadway essentially for the same amount of time. Newsies has announced a closing notice. Once has not yet, but it will any day now. I don't know why they haven't. But they've both grossed about $100 million. So they've been on since for 2.5 years. That is a really long run for any musical. That means they're among the 100 longest running shows in Broadway history. That's where they'll be when all is said and done. They're going to be over the 1,000 performance mark. Newsies has grossed $109 million. Once, which has much lower operating costs because the
operating
actors
or operating?
Operating. Once costs a lot less to put on, and it's grossed $100 million. So Once has probably been more profitable. So they've been neck and neck all the way. Once won the Best Tony Musical, but they both have been big commercial successes. Newsies has announced its closing date. It's just, I think it may have closed last week. Once is about to close, you know, announce its closing date. And you have Cinderella, which opened the same
January of 2013.
January of 2013, and they've grossed $75 million. So they're coming on strong. They had much bigger weeks than those guys, but they're fading fast, and they have stunt celebrity casting. I'm not sure why they are still open. I'm not sure why they keep announcing new people to put in the show. It's right towards the bottom of the list. It looks like it's losing money week to week. I don't know what's going on in their heads.
Well, and when Motown opened, or even before when it was proposed, you said, oh, this show has never worked. And
no, I did not say that. I just said I was afraid to invest in it because...
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Because Barry Gordy was involved.
Yes.
He was involved in the writing of it. He was producing it. He was all over it. And I didn't trust him to let other people step in and make it a great show. And in fact, it's not a great show, but it is a commercial success. I knew it was a name brand, you know, easy sell. It hurt me not to invest in it. But knowing A, he was in charge, and B, that he wouldn't let me have any profits anyway, probably.
That's true.
It would like never go to net profits if Barry Gordy is keeping the money. I'm sure he's an honest, wonderful man. I'm just saying. But he's a good businessman who knows how to hold on to his money. Let's put it that way.
He's a record label executive.
Yeah, I just said, you know, it hurts me not to get involved in this one, but I don't think I can do it. So the show has been a big hit, and it's now closing.
Okay. Well,
so what the heck's going on?
I don't know. I was asking you what was going on. Then I heard about Cinderella, Aladdin, Once, and all these other shows. I wanted to know.
I wanted to catch up on all the Broadway news. We got all these shows that are fading away. Bullets Over Broadway is gone. Rocky is gone. If Then is about to go. Newsies is gone. Once is about to go. There's a big change of the guard on Broadway. And Motown is putting a whole new spin on that. They have been losing some heat for a while to Kinky Boots and then Aladdin and Beautiful, the Carol King musical. It was a big hit for all of 2013. It was making $1.3 to $1.5 billion a week. And then in the beginning of this year, it collapsed. It's still a hit, but it went from grossing just about, you know, what it was before to like maybe about a million, maybe sometimes 1.1 million, a lot more often, $900,000. According to the New York Times, this is a big show, it costs $850,000 a week to run.
Wow.
That means that's the weekly nut. That's, remember our friend in South Korea said that's very standard now. $700,000 to $800,000 a week for a big Broadway show. That's very, very typical. So if you're not making $800,000 a week, $900,000 a week, you're barely breaking even or you're losing money for a lot of shows. Now, it depends show to show. You look at something like Once, that has a lower operating cost because it's a small cast and they play their own instruments. And that saves you money. It was a creative choice, but it's cheap. It's one set, small cast. They play their own instruments. There's no, you know, no orchestra. Saves you a lot of money. So this show, Motown, has been doing well, but it's faded. It's grossed $92 million. It's just gone on a road tour for 16 weeks. It grossed $20 million on its initial tour. And now it's opening in London. And what they're going to do is they're going to close the Broadway show, take the sets, take the costumes, and move it all to London. And now they're going to go on tour. They've been touring before. They're going to keep touring. And they're going to bring it back to Broadway in January. I'm sorry, in July of 2016. I don't know if any show has
ever
done
that. They're eligible for the Revival Tony Award?
No, because it will be essentially the same show.
Okay.
So no, it won't be. And I don't know what stars will be in what, but it won't be a revival because it's essentially the same show returning. And that's happened before. Shows return to Broadway. They go on tour. Maybe they come back for a little, you know, grand finale, little tour, squeeze out some more money. I'm sure that's been happening since the 20s. Not that there was a lot of big road show. I don't know when that began, blah, blah, blah. But I know shows have come back at the end of a tour for a couple of weeks. If they can do it, it's cheap and they can make some money. So that's not new. But to close for so long and to announce you're returning and to do it with the same people, that's very unusual. And what they've really made a point about saying is they're going to be bringing back the road production. You know, when you're on the road, you have usually a smaller cast, more people doubling roles. You have a smaller orchestra. It's cheaper to run. And ironically, you play in bigger houses. So when you take a show on the road, if it works on Broadway, that's why you keep a show that's sort of marginally a hit on Broadway, keep it going. Because the road tour is where you can make a lot more money. You've got fewer actors, fewer musicians, lower operating costs, and bigger houses with higher ticket prices. So suddenly, a show on Broadway that you can play to, you know, 2,000 people, you're in 3,000, 4,000 seat arenas, and you can make a lot more money.
Yeah.
So what's happening is they've pared down the cost of Motown on the road. And on Broadway, it costs $850,000 a week. On the road, it costs $675,000 a week. That's according to the New York Times and the producers of the show. They've gone down from 41 actors to a cast of 33 actors. A couple less people in the chorus, fewer gypsies, one or two people maybe doubling some more roles. And they have 18 musicians on Broadway. And on the road, they have 15. So that's a drop of 11 people, you know, from a total of 59 people. They go down to 48 people. Well, that's a big difference. They're going to bring that road show back to Broadway. And they've told everybody they're going to do that.
So that's what's unusual here, is that they're actually saying ahead of time, hey, that's what we're doing.
We're coming back. We're officially coming back. We've got a return date, and we're bringing you the road production. All of that is very unusual to make a noise about or to make a stink. And it's not that they're celebrating the fact that the show is going to be smaller. And in fact, they insist, well, we won't necessarily have exactly the road show. Maybe they'll bump up one or two actors. So maybe instead of 11 fewer people, they'll have 9 fewer people, something like that. Okay. They say it'll be somewhere in the middle, but it's going to be cheaper to run. And that way, they believe they can have a much longer second run on Broadway because it costs less to put it on. So that's a really unusual thing. What do you call it? You call it the Motown boomerang effect?
Yes, the Broadway boomerang effect. You can, I'm going to trademark that, Broadway boomerang.
That's right. So you've got now other shows, if this works, they're going to say, hey, we're a name brand and we can come back. The question is, how do you count that? Well, does that count as one long extended Broadway run? Does it count as two runs? It's certainly not a revival. Well, you know, the statisticians, the people who keep the books, they're going to have a big question to answer.
True.
So you were bored by all of that, weren't you?
I kind of like the Emmys, I kind of zoned out, and I was waiting, frankly, for the part of our show where we do the obituaries, much like I was waiting for the In Memoriam section yesterday on the Emmys, mm-hmm. Because I knew Billy Crystal was going to be there and doing a special kind of tribute to Robin Williams, the comedian, actor. I mean, we all know him.
Why did they have my friend Aaron mentioned this, in memoriam tribute to Shirley Temple? She has nothing to do with television.
I couldn't figure that out either. There were a couple.
Eli Wallach and Lauren Bacall have actually won Emmys. They've been on television. Juanita Moore has very modest television credits. She was a trailblazer in film. God bless her. But, I mean, that's pushing it a little bit. And Shirley Temple? I mean, give me a break. I mean, I'm sure she's appeared on TV, I guess. But, you know, she didn't do anything on TV. It just seemed like a ridiculous stretch.
Well, Robin Williams got a start on TV. Well, actually, a start in stand-up comedy, but
absolutely.
But he became a big star on Mork and Mindy.
Thanks to Happy Days.
And he died. I was in San Francisco when this news was announced. I can tell you that is not a town that was very. They were just for like 2 days. They were in a haze.
Yeah, no, he was a big figure in that town. And it was something that you really saw the impact of somebody when you saw how many people talked about it, looked about it. I mean, you know, old people, everybody thought, oh, you know, they were very sad about that. Obviously, we found out he was in the early stages of Parkinson's. That may have had something to do with suicide. Very sad news. You want to remember the good things. I interviewed Robin Williams once for Good Morning Vietnam, and I was in person on a sleazy press junket, which is the only type of press junket there is. But I was a college student. They wouldn't let us do the interview on the phone. They said you had to come there and do it. So we agreed to go on the sleazy press junket, went to San Francisco, did the interviews there at a round table. And I'm, of course, trying to be professional. And if you've ever been on a press junket, there are a lot of
non-professionals, that's for
non-professionals
sure.
Who just go, you're so wonderful. They ask banal, you know, questions that would make you, your eyes glaze over and you just can't believe how dumb they are. And you're embarrassed to be sitting with them trying to do an interesting interview. And it's one of the first interviews I've done with a well-known celebrity. So I'm a little press shy about that. And I really like Rob Williams and he's very funny. He was on and he was making everybody laugh. And I would smile, and it wasn't like I was a grumpy Gus, but I was professional, and I was just going to, you know, be there ready to ask my professional questions and be professional. So, of course, I would, you know, acknowledge the humor, but I wasn't there to be entertained. I was there to ask serious probing questions, and he saw that I was sort of resisting a little bit, and he saw that he didn't quite get me, and so he was sort of kept sort of, you know, working me over and doing things. And then he finally lighted upon William F. Buckley Jr. And he does an imitation of William F. Buckley Jr. And he suddenly went, ah, yes, you know, and he just went into a little shtick. And I sort of giggled and cracked. And he's, aha! And he went in and leapt in and did like a 2-minute thing on William F. Buckley and made me giggle helplessly. And then we moved on with the interview.
It just goes to show you how aware of his audience he always was. And, you know, and by the way, I think what Billy Crystal did yesterday, yes, he told the story about Robin Williams in baseball, which he's told before, and we've all heard Billy Crystal tell that story before, but that's the way In Memoriam should be done, if at all possible, where people who knew the person can tell a personal story about them. And you know, my personal story with Robin Williams, and it seems like anybody who worked in the entertainment industry seems to have had one, because we all worked with him, or not with him, but interviewed him or were around him for some reason or other at one point in our careers. Myself, I was lucky enough to be around him on as both a journalist and professionally. And he was always nice, but always on when there was more than about three people. And when I spent a whole day or two with him at Sundance for 1 hour photo. And when he was alone, he was much different than when he was with, you know, when he knew he had to
be on.
Yeah.
Most stand-ups are not waka waka when there's when they're one-on-one and not on stage. And he tended to be more of that, I guess, if there was more than two people in the room.
Yes. And I really hope that, obviously his passing is tragic. The way he passed is tragic. You know, all suicides usually are. And you know what? I hope that people kind of begin to look into, I guess they're beginning to tie open heart surgery to depression. I hope that people really, if that there is any tie, that they
he had open heart surgery?
Yes.
Well, but he had depression for much of his life. Didn't they say that? That he's been fighting it for many years, not just since the open heart.
Yes. Although, it was exacerbated.
It can be exacerbated, perhaps.
Yes.
Well, yeah. Well, sure. It's always good to look at anything. Cure Parkinson's, for God's sake.
I noticed there were very few, if no shots of Les Moonves last night, the person who canceled his Robin Williams.
Oh, well, I don't think that was any. Les Moonves wasn't shown because nobody knows what he looks like except people in the industry.
True.
But more to the point, you can't have a personal story about every person who dies on the Emmys because there's 20 people, 30 people, 50 people. Anyway, Lord Richard Attenborough also died. He died at 90 years old, legendary actor and figure in British cinema. He was a better actor than director as far as I'm concerned. And he had a lot of good movies, more than you remember. He was in The Great Escape, Seance on a Wet Afternoon, The Flight of the Phoenix, Jurassic Park, of course, and quite a good Santa in the pointless remake of Miracle on 34th Street. Not a good movie, but he was a very good Santa.
Yeah, I think most people would remember his directing for Gandhi.
That's right. That's his big triumph for decades. He tried to bring Gandhi to the big screen. Legendary performance by Sir Ben Kingsley. Triumphed at the Oscars. Triumphed at the worldwide box office. Not a good movie as far as I'm concerned, but still nonetheless a personal triumph and, you know, winner of Oscars and every possible award. As big a, you know, peak as you can get in a career. So more power to him. It's no time to, you know, downgrade his directing skills. He's a fine actor, a nice person from all appearances. Menachem Golan. Was he a nice person?
I don't know.
I don't know if he was a nice person, but he sure was fun.
Yeah, I mean, I saw both Stephen Garrett and I saw, and I heard this news from Stephen Garrett.
Who is? A friend of ours from Cannes, and he has a company that cuts film trailers, among other things.
Yes, and he was, the name of the documentary was The Go-Go Boys, and it was about Canon Films in the 1980s and 70s and his rise to, I don't want to say stardom, but his rise as a
notoriety
producer.
Notoriety with him and his cousin Yoram Globus.
Yes, and so, you know, it was very interesting. He was there in a wheelchair. He looked very frail at the time, and I guess for good reason. He passed away less than 3 or 4 months later.
Somebody made me go to the roof of Cannes on some hotel for some press conference about some B-movie that I don't think was ever made, but it was a Goran Globus film of some sort. I think it was post-Canon Films, but they wanted to get free champagne. I'm like, all right, I never go to those things, but I went because he really wanted to go. It might have been Steven. And we went. It was just total cheese ball. I think it was Jean-Claude Van Damme after his time had passed. I don't know what it was, but it was this very B or C movie. And there was, you know, there was Menachem Golan, and it just felt like, this is Cannes. You know,
yes.
They were very colorful guys. Big splashy parties, huge announcements for movies that never got made, schlock from here to Sunday, but they also made movies. They made Chuck Norris, Charles Bronson films, Stallone. They made a lot of movies with a lot of people. Most of them were terrible, but they made some good ones too, almost by accident.
Yes, it did seem like they were almost. His whole thing was
money. Let's make a good make money.
Yes, and Golan Globus, you know, Yoram Globus. They were, you know, together. I guess that was his cousin, Yoram Globus.
Yeah.
They made, like, Barfly, I think, was one of them.
Yeah, that's a good movie.
And, you know, it's their whole philosophy, make as many movies as you can.
That's right.
But then they started to get expensive. That's when things went south.
Fell apart for them. But, yeah, they kept doing it right up to the end. And he got to start with who? Roger Corman.
Ah, okay.
Roger Corman never got expensive. He said, no, that's not me. But I like this. Shelley Winters, who's a great broad, she worked on a couple Canon films. You know, they had paychecks, and she probably got her check in advance, and then she went to work. And she was said to have compared them, of course, to the old Hollywood moguls. That's really who they were. She said, quote, they're like the old style bastards. We hated them, but they loved films.
Well, now, you mentioned Shelley Winters. Shelley Winters has a tie to Robin Williams. You know what that is?
No.
Popeye, 1980.
Oh, I didn't know she was in it. I've never seen it.
Oh, well, yeah. And get this. Sarah Bareilles sang Smile during...
The Charlie Chaplin song?
Oh, okay. That was going to be my question. Do you know who wrote that song? She sang this song during the In Memoriam section of the Emmys. And yes, you know who wrote the song. Charlie Chaplin.
Well, Shelley Winters was a great broad, and so was Lauren Bacall, and I think she would appreciate that sort of appellation. A beautiful Hollywood star, great talent, stage success with musicals, big success on film right from the get-go with her and Humphrey Bogart, and To Have and Have Not, one of the great movies of all time, damn near as good as Casablanca, and it doesn't get higher praise than that. Just a great, great figure, a big liberal force in Hollywood with Bogey, you know, a campaigner for noble causes, fighting right up to the end. Oscar nominee for The Mirror Has Two Faces with Barbara Streisand as director. She should have won. She was robbed, but Juliette Binoche took it away from her. Sorry, Juliette. And, you know, she died at 89. What a life.
Yes. Well, and I told people that if you waited until the end of the show, you would find out why we had our unplanned hiatus. So, Michael, I'm going to let you take
it away.
That's
right, because we have one more obituary. My dad, William H. Giltz, William Harry Giltz. Actually, it's kind of funny. His name is Harry because my whole life I thought his name was William Henry Giltz. And he died on August 10th. We buried him on August 18th. It was like a state funeral. It took 9 days before we could bury him. But anyway, he died just 2 weeks ago. He was 87, long life. We were all happy and relieved that he died at the end. You know, the last 2 years, he's had very little quality of life. He's just sort of basically in his home. He was kept warm and comfortable, but he didn't get out very much. He couldn't play tennis anymore. He wasn't having any fun. He had dementia. So we just wanted to keep him out of a nursing home as long as possible. So we were relieved that he was home up until the last 4 weeks of his life. And he only spent a week in a hospital and 3 weeks in a nursing home. And he never really knew he was there. So it was not sad that he died. It was hard to see him alive, but it was a relief to see him go then because he was done. So it's not a sad time. We're happy to, you know, remember him. But his name was Harry, not Henry. I saw the death certificate and I said, oh my God, they made a mistake, Mom. It says Harry. His middle name is Henry. She said, well, actually, it's Harry.
Oh,
what do you mean it's Harry? She said, well, I never liked Henry. I never liked Harry, so I just changed it to Henry. On their wedding certificate, it says Henry. On all our school stuff, it says Henry. My whole life, I thought his name was Henry. And she had just changed it to Henry, you know, from Harry to Henry because she didn't like the name Henry. She didn't want to be married to William Harry Giltz. So she changed his legal name is Harry, and she just changed it. She said, well, he didn't mind.
But on a death certificate, I guess it does have to be official.
Well, she's really into genealogy, so she didn't want to have it wrong there. You know, her wedding certificate, she's like, I'll make it Henry. But she knew to not have confusion, she needed to go back to Harry, so she had no choice. So, you know, my dad, you know, people who follow me on Facebook or Twitter have seen that he died. You know, it's nice for people who reached out. But, you know, I have like one or two memories of him that tie into showbiz. One is that he could create songs right off the top of his head. He could just make up a song out of the blue on any topic you picked. And this is a guy who never listened to music, never played an instrument. He would sing along with everyone, but then he'd say, ah, I hate music, you know, jokingly. But like he sang and goofed around with music all his life, though I never saw him sit down and listen to an album. But if you asked him and said, oh, did you ever see Benny? Of course I saw a Benny Goodman concert. We hung out together and had drinks. And for all I know, it was true. But he could make up a song off the top. He could make up a song off the top of his head. It was amazing. You know, like he'd be with little kids driving in a car and they'd say, make up a song. And say, okay, well, what should I make up a song about? And like, well, it's raining. He'd go, okay, I'll make up a song about the rain. All right, let me think. And he'd go, he'd think for a moment, then he'd just start to go, I'm singing in the rain. I'm singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling. I'm happy again. The sky. And they go, oh my God, that's so great. Oh my God, write that down.
But that's a song.
That is so good. And he'd say, nah, it'll never be a hit. And they'd never know. They never figured out that it wasn't a Bill Giltz original because they were 8 or 10. He would do that all the time. Putting on the Ritz, he made them all up. He could make up a song about anything. It just had to already exist. He'd enjoyed lying if it made life more entertaining. And the last movie he saw with my mom in a theater was actually Titanic, which he said they did all wrong. But before that, it was Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Dr. Strangelove came out in Bermuda. It was 40 years before they saw another movie. Came out in Bermuda. And it was, of course, very controversial. It's a movie about nuclear war, but it's funny and black, and they didn't know what to think of it. And the Bermudians were confused by the movie. The whole world was confused by the film. It was Stanley Kubrick. They didn't know what to think, what to do. But my mom and dad went to see the movie in Bermuda, and everybody is sitting there sort of bemused and quiet. And my dad is roaring with laughter, laughing his head off. He's the only one in the theater. And when they're leaving the theater, they're walking out, and two little ladies point at my dad and say, oh, he really enjoyed the movie. And my mom never went with him again. too embarrassing. So there you go. So that's the obituary for my dad.
Well, I was very sorry to hear about your dad. I know how close you guys were.
Sure. He is my father.
Well, yeah, but, you know, some people are not very close to their parents. Some others are, and others, you know, it's
complicated.
Yes, it is complicated.
Right. Let's move on to listener email.
Well, this isn't very complicated. Do you want to read this? You want me to read this?
It's directed to me, so I guess I should read it.
Okay.
Did he put the subject in his email?
Yes, he did.
Okay, it's from Tukudza. I hope I'm saying that correctly. He's the Zimbabwean-born med lab scientist living in Melbourne, Australia. Wow. All right, that's a life right there. He says, subject, Michael, please let Sperling speak. Hi, guys. I love your show, and I never miss it. I have just one suggestion. Michael, can you please let Sperling finish talking before you cut him off? On your last episode, which is about 4 months ago, at about 45 minutes, Jay is trying to explain how the agent's egos may get in the way of contract negotiations, and you keep cutting him off. I find these sort of behind-the-curtain insights Jay has very interesting, and it's part of the reason I love the show so much. I use this stuff to casually impress my peers all the time. Thanks, guys. Keep doing what you were doing. It's awesome. Tukudza.
Now, what's interesting is when we first started this umpteen years ago, okay, like four or five. One of the things that we set out to do was actually convey information to listeners that they could then in turn, you know,
impress their friends.
Exactly. That was like one of the reasons we did it, and it's working.
Yay. Now, if only I wasn't such a jerk.
Well, in all fairness, there are times where, you know, I'm not Mr. Broadcast over here. So I at times stammer and stumble. I can't remember what point I was trying to make or even what the next sentence should be. And then you cut me off and I just think, oh, thank God, because I had no idea where I was going with the statement or no idea what I was supposed to be saying next. And so very often I'm relieved when you cut me off because I like right now, for instance, you should be cutting me off. Hello, Michael? You see, this is the problem when two people are not in the same place and they record a show. It just does not work.
Well, I've been trying to get better, and I'm going to call him T, Takudza. I don't know how to say that, but I appreciate the comment. We've been talking about this for a while. I thought it was our thing that I interrupted Sperling, but I'll try and do it less and make it more part of the flow of the show rather than an annoying interruption where he can't get out what he really wants to say.
Well, now, Takudza sent his email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And then Captain Ron gave us a call. He called 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Here is what... Now, you might recall, Michael, we actually talked about this. Guardians of the Galaxy, a movie theater, I believe it was in Virginia, they played the wrong Guardians movie. They played Rise of the Guardians, the animated film. And I couldn't figure out why, and I was trying to figure out why at the time. I still am trying to find out the official reason, but my gut told me, hey, you know what? I think they probably had some summer run of animated films that they invited kids to, and I bet you Rise of the Guardians was still at the theater, the digital file.
In the system.
Now, here's what Captain Ron had to say.
Hey, Sperling. Captain Ron here. Listen, on the latest episode, Michael was really curious as to why they would have an extra copy of Rise of the Guardians around. Well, come to find out, you were right. Regal Cinemas plays their Summer Movie Express for $1 at several theaters around the area. And the week of, at least here in Southern California, July 1st and 2nd, Rise of the Guardians and Adventures of Tintin were both playing in the theaters. So that would explain why it was. And when we went to see Rise of the Guardians, that was that week. Now, as far as the new movies that are out, when we went, we did see at least 30 minutes of trailers. So you were correct. Not too far out of reach, but the new movie is really, really good. Thanks. Great show.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in, Captain Ron. It's good to get that clarification.
Yeah. Well, and I was kind of glad I wasn't too far off there.
No, not at all.
Although 30 minutes of trailers, come on.
I'm just shocked that they played Guardians of the Galaxy. What's it called? Rise of the Guardians. Right. And Tintin. I mean, how many people were there to see Tintin?
You know, my kids liked Tintin. Rise of the Guardians, you could just tell they checked out. It wasn't necessarily. It's one of those things. I don't know what a good movie is, but I know it when I see it. It's like, you know, you want to know whether a movie works, put kids in front of it. And if it's a kid's movie, you'll know whether it works or not by how they get restless and how they respond.
That's right. Schindler's List doesn't work.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's how Captain Ron got in touch with us. How can other people get in touch?
Well, dirt@showbizsandbox.com or call 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts away for free, aggregate podcasts, whatever podcatcher you use, you can subscribe to us for free. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox, or you can go to our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/showbizsandbox, or if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, we should come up there. You can like us there. That information, the ways to subscribe to us, follow us, email us, call us, all of that can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has an ever-evolving website. What is it this week, Michael?
It's actually his middle name really was harry.com.
Ooh, that's actually a good one. You know, you may also want to try the Huffington Post, or you can try michaelgiltz.com for some of his other work and writing. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, and this time we mean it, next week, play nice.